Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, the unrelenting march towards recession. Is it really inevitable? And if so, how bad are we talking here? Ofgem have made a stab at sorting out the energy market mess. Is there actually anything good in there? Meanwhile, Britain has a gas surplus and tumbling wholesale price. So why aren't our bills falling too? And Crane is back on the case to help a reader whose dream holiday was cancelled. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, unemployment is falling, wages are growing. So is all the gloom and doom of late just a little bit overblown? Alas, no. Experts warn this fresh data is obscuring a rather worrying outlook for the British economy. The reality is that fewer people are in work than before the pandemic, and costs are rising much faster than pay. CPI inflation jumped this week from 7 to 9%, and no one thinks it's going to stop there. While the British economy is recovering pretty well from last year's pandemic-induced recession, the picture doesn't look that rosy. So is a recession inevitable? Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Helen. Simon, dig a little bit more into the ONS figures for me. Lift the bonnet. What did it reveal?
It revealed something which will come as a shock to nobody. Energy prices are going up a lot. In fact, they have gone up a lot. They went up a lot in April. Price cap rose 54%. There are more and more people going on to the energy price cap as fixed rate deals end, and they discover that there is almost no point in trying to switch because the fixed rate deals they'd be offered are way above the energy price cap. So most people are seeing their household energy bills rise substantially. In fact, the ONS said three quarters of the rise between March and April in the inflation rate came from household energy bills. The other stuff that is making a dent in our wallets and the spending power of the pounds in there is food and non-alcoholic beverages, recreation and culture, restaurants and hotels, miscellaneous goods and services, transport, communication. We are actually had a bit of a downward pressure from clothing and footwear, alcohol and tobacco, health. But the fact of the matter remains that the cost of living is going up very rapidly. Officially, 9% in a year. That's a big dent to the spending power that you have from the money that you earn, the savings that you have, etc. And it's expected to rise even further to about 10%. The question, of course, is how long does it stick around for? Does it remain stubbornly high for a very long period of time and then fall away, or does it fall away dramatically? And whilst economists are pretty much agreed on the inflation peaking at about 10% or just a shade higher than that, they are somewhat divided on the how quickly will it ever weigh.
What about these unemployment figures?
Well, those are good. I mean, you could unpick this in a number of different ways. I mean, in theory, potentially low unemployment is making the inflation picture worse because people are able to demand pay rises because there is a shortage of workers. And there was a suggestion that we may have reached full employment, as in as many people who want a job have got a job, beyond a sort of, there's a level of unemployment that's seen as just what's going to happen in an economy at any given time. So full employment isn't that literally every single person in the country has a job unless they are retired or children. But that does give people more bargaining power when it comes to their wages, which in economics terms is seen to be a bad thing because you risk a wage price spiral where people demand more for wages and then they go out and spend those wages, and that pushes the prices up further. And the companies that are having to pay those wages have to charge more money in order to cover the cost of paying those wages. On a personal level, though, it's just quite a good thing, isn't it? Because if you can manage to get your income to go up by as much as inflation, then you aren't losing out. Ideally, what you want to do is get your income to go up by more than inflation, because that means that actually you're getting richer. we have seen a prolonged period of falling real wages in this country since the financial crisis. We just about got ourselves back to the scenario where wages were going up in real terms, as in rising by more than inflation. And we've punted ourselves straight back into the bit where they're rising below inflation. Unfortunately, wages are rising at a fair clip, about 4%, if you exclude bonuses. But inflation is going up much faster than that. The bonus element is interesting, actually, in wages, because we think of bonuses as largely being the area of the high earning financial world, the city, lawyers, people who make lots of money get bonuses. People who don't make lots of money don't get bonuses. That's broadly speaking the way it works. But there is an interesting thing going on where there's actually quite a lot of bonus money being handed out to people who have done what are considered to be traditionally lower paid jobs. We've discovered that EasyJet this week is giving people £1,000 sign on and retention bonuses. We've already heard about HGV drivers being given bonuses in order to either stick around or to sign up with new companies. It's happening in the world of restaurants. Chefs are being given signing up bonuses or retention bonuses. And it's a way of saying to people, look, okay, we get it. We can't put your wages up by 10%. But I tell you what, here you go. We'll give you a couple of grand, but you've got to stick around. Or you've got to come and join us, which is obviously a problem for the companies trying to give people a couple of grand to stick around. And there's an interesting element of that coming into play in some of that those bonus figures. But if you just look at it from the big picture of what is going on in the economy, economy going okay, but GDP actually fell by a small amount, unemployment low, interest rates on the rise, inflation running at, I think, what is justifiably referred to as a sky high level, and Bank of England warning of recession, even as it's raising interest rates, which it says might be one of the things that causes the recession. But central bankers have totally changed their tune from being the most accommodating people in the world, particularly the US Federal Reserve, which has bent over backwards to keep stock markets afloat over the last decade and a bit, to suddenly going, oh, hang on, no, actually inflation is the thing we need to worry about. We are really worried about inflation. We are raising rates, even if it causes a recession, which is news to people who were being told not so long ago by those same central banks they didn't need to worry about inflation. It was transitory.
Yeah, it's a confusing picture. Helen, just your general opinion. Have they sort of stuffed up a little bit, central banks? Can they actually do anything useful as well in this situation, except continue to tell us not to ask for pay rises?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, isn't it? Because Simon's right, inflation was something that people generally weren't too worried about until it started hitting ridiculous highs. I mean, telling people not to ask for a pay rise is slightly ridiculous. I mean, people are always going to be worried about the pounds in their own pocket. They're not going to, out of the kindness of their hearts, not ask for a pay rise because, you know, to help
the good of the general economy. Yeah.
That's not how life works, is it? It's difficult because people see being in a recession as, oh God, you know, that's scary. That's why we don't want that to happen. But then, you know, the technical definition of recession depends on loads of different things. And we're already kind of hitting some of the markers for a recession. So, you know, if we were technically in a recession tomorrow, the situation for most people and the money in their pockets wouldn't actually change very much. Yeah. You know, they're already finding things are really expensive. They already have less money to spend. It's, you know, whether we technically tip into a recession or not for normal people doesn't actually make a huge difference to them day to day.
Simon, Economics 101, what is a technical recession?
That is when you have negative growth for two consecutive quarters. In normal person's language, that's when GDP shrinks for 2-3 month periods in a row. The year is divided into quarters. They obviously last 3 months each, and they are defined. And if you get two of them in a row where growth is negative, then that's a recession.
Likely, inevitable?
Likely, not inevitable, I think. We might just dodge it. We've dodged recessions before, interestingly. When we famously dodged the double dip after the financial crisis. In fact, sometimes we can revise our way out of a recession at a later date when we discover that the figures have been revised and actually the economy didn't shrink. From a personal level, recession is when stuff starts to feel quite painful for people financially. Normally, you will start to see job losses, the economy slow down. You will see, perhaps you might see the housing market start to sink. You walk around at the moment and it doesn't feel like there's a recession on the way. I mean, I must say that for all of the cost of living crisis, and people in every quarter are saying to me, yeah, I'm really starting to feel it now. There is still a lot of people out there spending quite a lot of money. This is a spectrum, and there are people out there who are really struggling. I listened to some really sad stories the other day of people on the radio who just do not know what to do in order to pay their bills, to pay their energy bills. And this is absolutely terrible that we have people in this situation in this country, particularly at the same time when there's other people out there who are complaining about how much their energy bill has gone up, but they're more than happy to be spanking £800 a month on a PCP deal on a car, you know, while they swank around in their brand new SUV. And there's a lot of people doing that in this country. The restaurants are full. Go out and people are spending lots of money. It is really poor that you can have a scenario where that's happening. And I don't think that the help that has been given to people is anywhere near enough, those people who are ultimately struggling to pay their bills. But that's the way of the modern world. You know, that you can be in a recession, you can be feeling the pinch and stuff can look like everything's okay. I remember financial crisis recession in London. You went out in the evening, didn't look, it was the Great Recession, it was called. It didn't look like the Great Recession when you were out in the pubs and the restaurants of London. So it just goes to show how the pain doesn't get shared around. Now,
but the reality is we do need people to go out and spend.
We do need people to go out and spend. And that's the paradox of thrift is people's natural reaction is to hunker down, to save money, to not spend. That is actually a deflationary force. That's the kind of thing that will send you into recession. We need people to go out and spend. But ironically, actually what the Bank of England wants is for people to not go out and spend at the moment, even though in its own inflation report, monetary policy report, it warned of a potential recession. It is raising interest rates to make the cost of borrowing money more expensive so that it is less attractive to people and to discourage people from spending. Because we need people to stop spending to try and stall the inflation, except most of the inflation doesn't come from people spending. It's coming from people's energy bills going up, which we have almost no control over whatsoever. So we are in a very strange time. But the thing I would say is that it's post-COVID, isn't it? It's post-lockdown. I think we convinced ourselves that everything had just rebounded straight back to normal and we shrugged off the whole COVID weirdness. Even at one point, even while we were still technically in lockdown in 2021, everyone was like, yeah, this is grand. I think we're pretty much back to normal now. And I don't think we are. And so then I have not so much sympathy for some of the central bank pronouncements. They're very much a, well, we just thought it was transitory. We couldn't see this coming. We didn't think it was going to stick around. We had people writing columns for us as far back as May 2020 saying that what was going on in terms of central bank action, cutting interest rates, quantitative easing, but also now directly giving money to people rather than putting it into the financial system, was going to prove to be highly inflationary in a way that things weren't after the financial crisis. And I think there's been an element of central bank groupthink where they all went, well, it was fine after the financial crisis, so it should be fine now. We don't need to worry about it and inflation will go away. But I'm scrolling back through the archive of our podcasts. We were talking about things that indicated that there was going to be an inflationary problem last summer and before. It's the anecdotal stuff. It's the hot tub stuff, the car hire crisis, all of those things like that. But the problem is And Andy Haldane, who was the chief economist of the Bank of England, maybe 15, 16 months ago, he gave a speech where he said, where he posited the idea of what if it's different this time? What if inflation does suddenly come surging forwards? What if we don't get away with all that printing money like we did last time? But because obviously, you know, monetary policy is a very data-driven way of doing things, and they look at what is in the data and they don't look at the what if it what could this be? That kind of stuff, the creative thinking. And mate, you probably shouldn't be making monetary policy based on creative thinking. But I do think maybe it might have been a good idea to have a look around at what was going on in the world at some point last year and say, do you know what? I think we could probably get away with raising interest rates a couple of notches now, and it might help us out a bit further down the line if inflation does stick around. And if inflation doesn't stick around, well, do you know what? At least we've managed to get interest rates off the floor and they're not at 0.1% anymore. But instead, central bankers did nothing.
But we've been making that argument, and perhaps it's a bit stronger now, obviously, but we've made that argument for like the last 10 years, Simon. You've been saying, like, could you not just do something? Isn't the problem with central banks, and this is not an episode to just smash the Bank of England at all, but it's just saying, are they not just thinking status quo is better than actually doing something?
Yeah, I think so. Proactive. And but it's very easy to be critical of a central bank when you're not actually a person on their monetary policy committee, and when you are...
it's a bit different writing when an article in a newspaper than actually making a massive decision that could impact the, you know,
true,
70 million
but
people.
It is a vote. They don't make it just as one person. And it's much easier with the benefit of hindsight. But what I'm saying is there's a bit of a rhetoric coming out at the moment from the central bank saying, well, it's easy for commentators to say this with the benefit of hindsight. And I'm just pointing out that this is not a scenario where nobody said this at the time. There were people raising the point that actually maybe this inflation might not be as transitory as central banks think. But, you know, I didn't think it was going to go this high. I never thought that inflation would go this high. I also didn't think interest rates would rise as quickly as they have done, to be perfectly honest. And I mean, the final thing I'd say on it as well is it's all very well asking people not to ask for a pay rise or to tell them to think twice about asking for a pay rise, but if you earn 570 grand a year, maybe just keep your mouth shut on that one, even if you are the boss of the Bank of England. I don't see any way that that story is going to play out well unless it's maybe being published for an audience who think 570 grand a year is a bit of a low salary and they wonder how someone gets by on that.
Possibly, Simon, possibly. Helen, let's be a bit more practical, shall we? Whether we have a technical recession, as you said, or not, it's going to feel kind of like it. Feels kind of like it now for a lot of people. Is there anything we can do to recession-proof our finances?
There is. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people who this is just going to be completely insurmountable for, like people whose energy bills have gone up by hundreds of pounds a month, people who don't earn an awful lot of money. In many cases, there really isn't a lot they can do. As Simon said, you know, for somebody who's absolutely catastrophic, they have no idea how they're going to pay their bills. The only thing they can do is try and cut down the energy they're using, which is extremely difficult. I mean, okay, it's summer, so you're perhaps not using your heating, but you know, you need to eat, you need to have a hot shower. It's, you know, there's a certain point at which, you know, it's almost flippant to say to some people, you know, try and cut this down. I mean, the kind of things you can do is, you know, if you're lucky enough to have savings, make sure you're getting a decent interest rate on them. Things like look to, if you've got a remortgage coming up, look to lock that in now at a decent rate. But you know, this kind of thing is all for people who are in the scheme of things kind of comfortably off. For people who aren't, you know, it's really difficult. And you know, the kind of things they can do is to look for support from, so you know, go to your energy supplier, go to your local council, they might be able to offer you some kind of financial support. But those sort of things, you know, they can't help everyone, and I think it's a really difficult situation for a lot of people.
Right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro to talk about what's been going on the markets this week and what we've got to look forward to next week. Sam, it's been another busy week, hasn't it? We say that every week, don't we? What's been going on?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's been another super volatile week in global markets. There's been periods where we've had some indexes that at one point in the day have been up 1%, and then a few hours later have been down 2% and more. In terms of direction, mostly risk assets have still come under pressure. I mean, it's pretty much a perfect storm for that out there. We're seeing continued bad macro outlook, slower growth and higher inflation. Just on Wednesday in the UK, we saw inflation coming in at 9%. a four-decade high. And to put that into perspective, 4 decades ago when inflation was that high previously, interest rates recovery, from a scheduled point of view, it's going to be quiet, but it was this week really, other than that inflation number. I guess market participants will be keeping an eye on the recent minutes from the last US central bank meeting. We might gain a further insight into how they're going to manage this current situation.
Speak to you next week.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Ah, to think that this time last year, energy suppliers were falling over themselves to entice new customers in by offering rock-bottom tariffs. Alas, no more. Dozens of firms don't even exist anymore, and average energy bills are an eye-watering almost £1,900 and expected to climb even higher. Some experts say as high as £2,800 come October. So in rides the regulator Ofgem this week with a new strategy that's going to sort out all of this mess. Right? Right? Helen?
So this is only a proposal at the moment. It's not definitely going to happen, but basically, at the moment, Ofgem puts up the price cap, which is the maximum that can be charged per kilowatt hour on a default tariff. So these are the tariffs that people drop onto when their fixed contracts end. They're the cheapest option for people in most cases now, because the price of fixes has gone up so high. So they're currently reviewed twice a year. Ofgem wants them now to be renewed 4 times a year. So that would mean that they could go up 4 times a year instead of twice a year, or down. They can go down as well. And what Ofgem's saying is that this will mean that when the price of gas does start to fall, those savings will be passed on to consumers quicker. But it obviously also means that while prices are still rising, there would be more frequent increases. So households would end up paying more, more quickly.
Wouldn't it just even out, or is that not the case?
I mean, it would essentially mean that any changes would be reflected in household bills more quickly. We don't yet know when prices might start to fall. It certainly doesn't seem like it will happen this year. So if the price cap was able to go up more often, that would mean some quite immediate kind of pain for people who are struggling at the moment. The real kind of purpose behind it seems, is to prevent more energy companies from going bust. So last year, 30 companies went bust. And when that happens, the costs of kind of administrating that whole process are passed on to customers through their bills. So that ends up hiking up energy bills even more. So the theory is that if energy companies can pass on the increased cost of energy onto their consumers more quickly, that'll mean that they don't go under, because they can put up prices accordingly compared to the amount that they're having to pay. But at the moment, it would be disastrous for people, the price going up every 3 months rather than every 6 months.
The price that's factored in, I think, Simon, for these failing companies is about £68. Is that right? For a £1,900 total bill? Not insignificant, but not huge. Was there more in this to protect companies than to protect consumers? What else was in there?
It depends what way you look at it. So Ofgem have said that the advantage of this is that, for a start, it wouldn't come in for some time. Okay, so it's not going to come in immediately. So it would probably come in as energy prices hopefully start to fall, which would mean that people get falling energy prices passed on to them quicker. The argument against this is that effectively the price cap discourages energy firms from offering cheaper fixed rate deals that are cheaper than the price cap. I mean, those just don't exist at the moment, right? There's no point trying to switch at the moment. Any fixed rate deal you go to, going to be more expensive than the price cap. Once you work it out, you'd spend more time paying the higher rate while waiting for the price cap to get anywhere close to it than it makes it worth taking the deal. When prices start falling, then things change around. But if people anticipate that in 3 months' time, their energy price is going to fall anyway, they're not going to have to wait 6 months, they're only going to have to wait 3 months, then they are less likely to go out and search for a cheap fixed rate deal. Suppliers are less likely to offer a cheap fixed rate deal. There's also something else in the energy price cap that's been put in since April called market stabilization charge. Now, the idea is that this is a charge whereby if wholesale prices fall 30% below the price cap, so a long way, okay, they have to fall 30% below the price cap, that the energy supplier offers a new cheap fixed rate deal and lures someone from another energy supplier, then they pay the energy supplier that they have lured the customer from a fee in order to help cover the money that they have lost due to the fact that they have probably sensibly, hopefully, bought the energy in advance for a certain number of customers. And there's a whole big problem going on here with the multitude of energy companies that we had, some of whom weren't buying their energy far enough in advance. They were buying it on the wholesale markets. They then discovered that the customers were protected by the price cap, and that the price cap meant that they were actually giving customers energy for less than they were paying for it. But also there was the problem with fixed deals. Could you get a fixed deal? Couldn't you get a fixed deal? Coming off a fixed deal onto the price cap, suddenly seeing prices spike. So there's a bit of a mess here that needs unpicking. And one of the chief pieces of criticism of Ofgem has been this market stabilization charge and the fact that this is due to go up. Now, Ofgem did confirm that nobody has actually been charged the market stabilization charge yet, but that is because it only kicks in when wholesale prices fall 30% below the price cap.
Haven't they changed it to 10% rather than 30%?
And that is the highly controversial thing that is also being discussed here, along with shifting the price cap to 4 times a year, because obviously 30% is quite a large amount. And the reason why nobody's paid it yet, 10% all of a sudden starts to be fairly realistic that people are going to have to pay it. What Ofgem is trying to do is stop us having the Wild West energy market that we had in the past that led to companies collapsing left, right and centre and caused complete chaos, with many small energy companies collapsing, but one larger one had to be taken into effectively state ownership, Bulb. And some of the criticism of this is coming from people who make money from energy switching. Okay, you have to remember that the comparison industry and those connected to it, I'm not saying that anybody doesn't have the interests of consumers, the best interests of consumers at heart, but the energy market, as it worked with people switching energy suppliers all the time, that turned out to not really work very well when the stress of rapidly rising prices kicked in, was highly beneficial in terms of commission being earned from people switching energy suppliers. And I say that as the editor of a website that has a partnership with a comparison site to help people switch energy deals. And the reason why we have that is because it helps people save money. It helps you move to a better deal. For many years, our partnership was run by Energy Helpline, and then most recently it's been run by Compare the Market. You can't do an energy comparison with our energy switching service at the moment because the energy market is so broken that basically you just can't compare prices. And even if you did, you would discover that there's no point switching. You'd be better off on the price cap. So we also, when people use that service, we earn a small affiliate fee, and that's the thing that helps keep This Is Money free to use. You don't have to pay to read This Is Money. It's free to use, and we make our money from advertising and also from affiliate revenue. We are entirely honest about that, make it entirely clear on the site. But I do think sometimes when you hear people talking about, you know, well, it's going to stop people switching and everything like that, you do need to remember that sometimes people are saying that from a point where they might be making money off the fact that people are switching. It's not to cast aspersions on what they're saying, but it does need to be borne in mind. So there you go.
Agreed, understand, and really appreciate you said that, Simon. But there are also, in the defence of the criticisms, I suppose, a lot of criticisms, and I think Helen pointed this out, particularly from charities like Citizens Advice, have said that, you know, perhaps this will reduce the risk of more supplier failures. Good news. Bad news is the impact this is going to have on people's household bills.
Yes. Bad news is the impact it's going to have on household bills, but the main impact on people's household bills is the price of energy spiking. That's what's causing the real damage to people's household bills. The reason why energy companies aren't offering cheap fixed rate deals is because the price of energy is sky high. It's not because of the market stabilization charge. That will certainly probably crimp the fact that them offering cheap fixed rate deals. Will they just abandon them altogether? I don't know. I mean, we've still got an energy market where there's a multitude of companies. To be honest, I think if you asked a lot of people out there whether they think the current energy market we have, with loads and loads of small companies, of which a ton of them went bust and then it just froze and hasn't worked very well, is better than the old-fashioned energy market where we had much less companies, they'd probably tell you they preferred the old one and they just wanted more fairer prices. The idea was that all of this competition would solve the problem of high prices in the energy market. You know, remember the old breaking up the big six and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. It's not been entirely successful, but out of the back of it have emerged, you know, some much better competitors and some big players that do challenge the big six. I don't know. It's all a bit of a mess, in all honesty. I think what people would like is just for their energy bills to start falling rather than going up. And unfortunately, they're probably going to go up again by quite a bit in October. But the good news is that maybe, just maybe after that, they might start to come down.
It is a bit of a mess. Is there anything in here that makes you think, yeah, we're going in the right direction, this could sort out this mess? Because I don't know. Forgive me. Is there any other industry where if you offer a cheaper deal or a better deal to your competitor, you have to pay them? I mean, it all just seems a lot of tinkering around the sides, but not really sorting anything out. Maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe I'm being ignorant and I've missed something.
I tell you, one of the issues here, and one of the reasons why this is here, is because obviously if you are on the energy price cap deal, you can just leave at any time for free. That's what they're trying to do. It's like that kind of like early repayment charge element. You know, it's like, so if you're on your lender's standard variable rate on their mortgage, you can leave at any time for free. But the kicker to that, to the mortgage lender, is the standard variable rate is inevitably much higher than the fixed rate deals that they are offering you. Now, in this instance, the market is being artificially meddled with, and energy suppliers are being told that they cannot charge people more than a certain amount to reflect their actual costs, which is why they have decided that they think it's a sensible idea to bring in some form of early repayment charge, which is levied not on the consumer, but on the company that they're going to, in order to provide some form of backdoor protection for the fact that energy companies are in many, many instances being told that they have to sell energy to people at a loss. I agree with you that that is an absolutely insane system, but that's where this thing comes from.
Helen, your views, what should Ofgem have done if not this?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to think of a solution they could have come up with that would really help consumers in a substantial way. I mean, out of Ofgem's hands, but the one thing that's being talked about at the moment as possible solution is a windfall tax on energy firms. The government don't want to do it, but there's increasing kind of pressure for them to tax these really big firms, because the thing we haven't mentioned, they still make billions in profits, the biggest firms. So there's this proposal for basically a kind of one-off tax on them, the government can then use to help people who are really struggling. I mean, there's an argument that these companies are making quite decent profits anyway, so if their profits go up, they pay more tax anyway. But it's, I mean, I think it's something that a lot of consumers would love to see. You know, they're not probably going to accept the argument that, you know, oh, these huge firms are really struggling as well. But I mean, yeah, it's a difficult one. Like you said, it's a mad market. It's a pretty insane situation. I would say, you know, the only things consumers can really do day to day is check your bills absolutely kind of rigorously. I get so many people writing to me at the moment saying they've been mischarged, especially when people are moving house and things like that. These companies are making mistakes, they're mischarging them sometimes into like the thousands of pounds. But even, you know, it might just be a small sum, but do just check what you're being charged. Get a smart meter if you can, do meter readings, just make sure you're really on top of what's going on with your energy bills so that you're not paying even more unnecessarily on top of these already really high prices.
But Yet, in amongst all this, Simon, wholesale gas prices in the UK have actually collapsed. Curiously, we've a glut of gas, and what's referred to as the spot price has tumbled. So why are our bills not falling as well? You've written about this week, Simon. What is going on?
Yeah, just when you thought that it couldn't get any more insane. This is a classic example of post-COVID economic insanity, and also a quintessentially British example of a lack of forward planning and basic competency. Right, so why does Britain have a glut of gas at the moment? More gas than we know what to do with. Well, because energy prices have spiked and Europe is trying to actively avoid buying Russian gas. Obvious reason, Russia invaded Ukraine, it's trying to impose sanctions. And most of Europe's gas comes through the pipeline from Russia. In the UK, we actually don't use much Russian gas. In terms of our UK gas that we use, about 50% of it comes from the Northern Irish Seas, about a third of it comes through pipelines from Europe and Norway, and the rest of it comes in as something called LNG, which is liquefied natural gas. And that's shipped in by tanker. And that is the reason why the gas wholesale price in the UK has tumbled way below the European measure. So ours is something called the NBP, and theirs is something called the TTF. And this measures day-ahead prices, what you'd pay for gas today if you wanted it delivered tomorrow. And what's happened is energy traders, as gas prices have spiked and Europe has decided that it doesn't want to be buying any more Russian gas or buying as little of it as possible, have spotted an opportunity to sell to Europeans. And so they have been shipping lots and lots of liquefied natural gas to Europe by tanker. However, mainland Europe doesn't have enough terminals where tankers can dock and the liquefied natural gas is turned back into gas and piped out. The UK, on the other hand, actually has three major terminals, and they represent about a fifth of Europe's total capacity. Therefore, we've been seeing lots of ships arriving here, docking, LNG comes in, it's regassed and sent off to Europe. But the pipelines to Europe and the interconnectors have been operating at capacity. So we can't actually get enough gas out of the country and over to Europe to meet the demand there. So we're building up a surplus here. And this has particularly been the case because the weather's got warmer, it's spring, people are using less gas to heat their homes, brackets, because they're absolutely terrified of how high their bills are going to be. And the law of supply and demand means if you've got too much of something coming in and not enough people that want it, then the price falls. And so the price in the UK has absolutely tumbled below the European price for day-ahead spot prices. Electricity prices have also fallen. We've had an increase in wind and solar generation, and the cost of gas-fired generation has tumbled because price of gas has tumbled. So why are we not sitting here talking about how great it is that we're suddenly paying that much less on our gas bills? Well, because energy suppliers don't buy today the money, sorry, energy suppliers do not buy today the gas that you are going to use to heat your home or hot water tomorrow. They buy it well in advance. Sensible ones do it about 6 months to a year or even longer ahead. The ones who weren't sensible went bust. Bulb was reported to be paying rates that were much closer to wholesale prices. So if it's not cutting our gas prices now, could it cut them in the future? Well, it's not that simple. Because whilst we have a decent amount of gas terminals for the LNG to come in, we have a shortage of gas storage in the UK. In fact, famously, we closed down our major gas storage facility not that long ago. Under this, I don't know whether it was Boris Johnson, I don't think it was Boris Johnson's government. I think it might have been David Cameron's government, or maybe it was Theresa May's, whoever, whatever. It was the same party that's running the country right now. And do you know what? The other party probably would have done exactly the same thing. Okay, just to be entirely clear,
we are
an apolitical podcast because they decided they didn't really need to pay for it anymore and they didn't want to subsidize it and it cost too much money. And we are in capable of thinking ahead and doing things properly in this country. You only have to walk down the street and look at the state of the pavements and the roads to see something that is symptomatic of modern day Britain. Anyway, back to the gas. So at the moment, we're exporting as much gas as we possibly can to Europe, where they are storing it in readiness for winter. Eventually, the surplus effect will ebb away. Gas prices between the UK and Europe will find some form of equilibrium, at which point it'll probably be round about autumn. And we'll turn our heating back on, start using more gas, and we'll probably start importing the gas back through the same pipelines, but paying more money for it.
Yeah.
Bravo us.
Is it a bit late to get them back going? The storage capacity? No, it's done. It's done. That ship has sailed, has it?
It has. It takes time to do these things. That's why you plan ahead. It takes time to do these things. Look, I'm going to put my hand up here and say that I have obviously massively oversimplified this story. I'm not a gas or an energy expert, and there are probably way more complicated elements to this than I am discussing. Mm. And yes, it was a big surprise. We did get caught out by this energy price spike. But I do think, as I said, it does display what is typical of modern day Britain in a total lack of forward planning and basic competency.
Yeah. Well, any gas and energy experts that want to furnish us with further details about this, get in contact. We'd love to know your views, as always. Finally, Crane is back on the case. I want to say, Helen, that you are always on the case. It's just, you know, when you're on the podcast, we say you're on the case. But, you know, you never stop basically helping readers out. And this week, you've been helping out a reader who sought a tax refund after his dream holiday plans were cancelled. He's still waiting for it. Explain.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So it's basically, it's kind of a little known trick which can help people get back a little bit of money if they've had to cancel a holiday at the last minute. So the reader who wrote in, really gutting situation. He planned this dream holiday to the Maldives with his partner, but she got COVID 2 days before they were due to fly. So everything had to be called off. Absolutely terrible situation. Luckily he had travel insurance, so he got the majority of his money back, but what he didn't get was this £164, which the insurer said it wouldn't refund. This is a tax called air passenger duty. And it's something that you pay unknowingly on any flight ticket you buy. It's basically, it's a tax that's held by the airline. And when you fly off on the plane, they have to pay that tax to the UK government for you kind of flying out of the UK. Now, if you cancel and don't get on the flight, you should, in most situations, be able to get that money back. It can be up to £185. It's more if you're on a longer flight and less if you're just going short haul. But you should be able to claim that back if you don't fly. The airlines and travel agents make it really, really difficult to do so. So this reader he kind of knew about this and he'd been trying to claw it back. He'd been sent around the houses between Blue Bay, who was the agent that he booked with, and Qatar, the airline that he was actually due to fly with. Both kept kind of passing it off to each other, saying, oh, you know, this isn't our responsibility. Oh, you booked with an agent, so they have to sort it out. They'd sent him completely around the houses for months. When I got involved, he did actually end up getting the money back. So it was £164, you know, not a huge amount of money, but why should the airline kind of keep it when you could be putting it towards another holiday or, you know, just a pint in a pub garden to make you feel better about cancelling your holiday to the Maldives.
There's a lot of pints for £164, although in London, perhaps not so many. I'm not sure where this person's from. Who eventually paid him back? Because they were saying it's the insurer, it's the travel company, it's the airline. Yeah, whose responsibility is it?
It was the agent that paid him back in the end. So the way it has to be done, the airline has to pay it back, but they pay, if you book through an agent, they pay it back to the agent. But what I found out was, this is a bit sneaky, so Blue Bay, the agent, they told me that it wasn't actually them that the airline paid it back to you directly. There was some kind of third party company that they do their bookings through. They wouldn't name them, which is a bit cheeky, but apparently they were the ones who actually got it back, and then they had to chase them up. So it's just a bit of a word of warning. When you book with one of these agents, you actually don't always know who is involved and what company your money's actually going to, who's making your booking. And I just want to, but you know, if you're the agent they've booked with, it's your responsibility. Own up, get them their money back, and just kind of sort it out. It's a bit of a word of warning, I think. Know what you can get back, know who owes it to you, and just don't give up, really.
Have they rebooked the holiday?
Not as far as I know. I really hope he will. But yeah, I'm sure he'll be off again somewhere soon, and possibly not booking via that agent again, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. What an unbelievable shame. But well done. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, perhaps you're an energy expert and you want to tell us more about what's going on at the moment, you know, we're very happy to receive it, aren't you, Simon?
Indeed. Yes, please. Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us at thisismoney and come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
My dad's an energy expert. I'd love you to get one from Bob Frost. That would be amazing. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.